And the title is The Might One.
So, first of all, again, my talk will follow a handout, and there are extra copies here and outside, and I really hope everybody has a copy. If not, please pick up one. Also, of course, thank you for the invitation, Thomas and Francois. And also, the phrase omega epsilon beta is hereby defined to mean this phrase here, and it's sort of on several places on the handout, and you can find more information about certain things over there, including a PDF version of this handout, and eventually also, and maybe later today, also a video of this talk. I should say that everything that I will say follows Rozanski and Overbay, and is joined with Van der Veen, Roland Van der Veen, pictures included. And I should also say that I actually plan to speak for less than an hour so as to leave time for questions and fighting and arguments and whatever it is that we would end up doing. So if you will want more details, you can find it at web/talks, where you will find links to several talks that I've given in the last year or so, in which all of this is done with much more detail. Okay? And all of them are also on video, so you can watch them if you care. My title is The Dogma is Wrong. And what I mean by that is not that any specific mathematics is wrong, but that treating this collection of mathematical things as a dogma is wrong. And so it's wrong as a dogma, not as mathematics. And so this is to comfort you. I don't mean that anything specific in mathematics is wrong, only that sort of the overly reverent treatment of that mathematics is wrong. On the other hand, which part of mathematics do I mean, or which part is it that I claim is wrong to treat as a dogma? It's the part where you say, let's choose a Lie algebra, that's fine, and a representation, and that's no longer fine. And that's the statement I just made is actually much stronger than it seems, because you see, I'm really telling you that anything you know about monoidal tensor category, I'm really fitting monoidal braided monoidal categories, right? That's basically the algebraization of choosing a representation. I'm fitting it into the dogma. And even worse, I'm telling you that all of TQFT fits into this dogma, because about what TQFT is. You choose a vector space for every component chunk of your space. Now, in what way is it wrong? It's wrong because if you choose a representation, or if you follow the dogma, then you choose a vector space for every chunk of your, you want to compute something, you cut it into pieces, and each piece has a value in some vector space, and then you assemble the pieces. But within that assembly process, you have to look at the combined result of all of the pieces, which lives in the tensor product of all of the vector spaces. Now, the tensor product of a collection of vector spaces has dimension that grows exponentially in the size of the collection. So if you're talking about an n crossing knot, and you want to compute its invariant following the dogma, then necessarily it will take you an exponential amount of time. The spaces that you have to consider along the way have exponential dimension. So anything you will do will be exponential time, which means that nothing you will do will be computable except for a few small nodes. And then there is sort of a miracle which makes the Jones polynomial more computable than that, and also Hovanov homology. So by sort of miracles, you can compute them for somewhat bigger nodes. But still, in principle, they're exponential. So in principle, you're bound to look at small things. What if you care about something bigger? Now, if there wasn't an alternative, then okay, that's what you would do. But there are alternatives, and we should take we should consider them more seriously. I gave a similar talk in Notts in Washington in December 2016, and the abstract there was much shorter. And let me rephrase it. I mean, you may or may not like my arrogance and my provocativeness and my obnoxiousness in general. It doesn't matter. Because what I'm going to tell you, and you may hate the formulas, but what I'm going to tell you about is the strongest truly computable not invariant we know. Strongest computable, period. So you cannot ignore that. Okay. And furthermore, I mean business. So it's not theory. Everything is tabulated. Only the beginning of the table is on the screen right now. But the rest is on your handout. This is for 10 crossing nodes, but I've computed somewhat beyond. So I claimed it's the strongest computable not invariant we know of, I know of. So here is some evidence, and I'll be sketchy about it. So first of all, here is log-log plot of computation times in second versus crossing number for all nodes with up to 12 crossing. This is here on the left. And basically, if something is polynomial time, then if you plot a polynomial on a log-log scale, it should look like a linear function. And well, it looks roughly like a linear function. Now, the scale, the numbers on the left, which are the numbers in seconds, 2, 5, 10, 20, 50, you should please ignore. I mean, these numbers, well, are not so bad, but they're actually horrible relative to what I expect things to be in the future. Basically, this is computation using draft programs. Okay. Likewise, here's the same thing. For torus nodes with up to 48 crossings, I think. And again, the times are much higher and because these are bigger things, but it still grows linearly. And again, you should still ignore the actual numbers because I think the eventual programs will be much faster. Though here it grows linearly, though with different slopes for different types of torus nodes. So if you look at the bottom of the of this diagram, you see the n, 2 torus nodes. And these are, of course, the easiest, and the computation time grows much slower than the sort of n-1 torus nodes, which tend to bound the upper side of this diagram. Okay. As for power, so again, I'm telling you experimental data. Okay. So if you compute this invariant, so let's call it rho 1, on the 250 nodes with at most 10 crossings, you find that the Alexander polynomial along with rho 1, so really the Alexander polynomial in some sense is rho 0. So it's you really can separate the two. So if you look at that, and both are polynomial time computable, so if you look at the power of that, you find that on the 250 nodes with up to 10 crossings, the pair gets 250 distinct values, meaning it separates all nodes with up to 10 crossings.
While if you take Hovanov homology, which includes the joint polynomial and Homfield PT together, well, they attain only 249 values, so it's slightly more powerful. But then if you do it to 11 crossings, the number of knots is 802, the number of values of omega, comma, rho 1 is 788, the number of values for Hovanov and Homfli is 772, so the difference gets bigger and gets bigger yet over here.
So this is the claim about this being powerful.
Next, so I don't want to go into details, but in some sense, row 1 is and similarly its extensions, row k and the other variants of it. So in some sense, they are perturbations of the Alexander polynomial. And the Alexander polynomial, in many senses, is the most powerful knot invariant we have, in that it is the best connected to topology. So using the Alexander polynomial, you can get a genus bound, so a bound of the genus of the knot, and it has something to say about ribbon knots and slice knots. And it has several other applications to topology. So in many ways, the Alexander polynomial is the best topological invariant of knots we have. And these being perturbations, they inherit some of the properties. In particular, you can read this paragraph in detail, but if you really wish, but the summary is that these new invariants actually do say something about the topology of the knot. In particular, they say something about the genus of the knot, and there are reasons why they should, and also, there is a schematic plan, which I will not review unless you ask. There is a schematic plan for how these new invariants, or not so new, but how these invariants should be or can potentially be usable in order to detect non-slice knots. And there is an old standing question whether non-ribbon knots. There is an old standing conjecture whether every slice knot is ribbon, and the smallest potential counterexamples are pretty large. So here is one, and it has 48 crossings. And there are reasons to think, which again, I am not explaining, but I could explain at some other point, that row 1 would be able to detect non-ribbon knots, in which case it may potentially show that this knot is non-ribbon, whereas it is known to be slice. But for any of that to work, of course, the invariant of a relatively big knot should be computable, and the next potential counterexamples are even bigger. So you really care about things being polynomial time. Maybe one last thing. So, as I said, row 1 in some sense is not new, and here is the sense. So maybe you want to look, so there are explicit formulas here, but you know, I don't think I want to go through the formulas, so maybe I'll just concentrate on just one box here, one table. So you can take the colored Jones polynomial, deep inside the dogma, completely impossible to compute in practice. So for all I know, the programs people use are still my programs. Am I right? Mm-hmm. No, I'm wrong.
Use recursion.
Okay, I'm sorry. But anyway, deep into the dogma and very hard to compute is the Collor-Jones polynomial. And the Collor-Jones polynomial depends on two parameters. So one parameter is h-bar that appears in all quantum invariants. And the other parameter is the dimension of the representation. And you can expand it as a power series in both. And if you expand it as a power series in both, you find that, so you get an array, a two-dimensional array of coefficients, and you find that all coefficients below the diagonal are zero. The coefficients on the diagonal make the Alexander polynomial, or more precisely, the 1 over the Alexander polynomial expanded in a certain way. And that, by the way, is the Melvin Morton Rosansky conjecture, which at some point was proven by Stavros and myself. And then the new stuff comes when you look at diagonals above the Alexander diagonal. So if you look at it from the perspective of the dogma, all I'm doing is I'm taking the Collar-Jones polynomial and expanding it in a funny way. But I think a better way to look at it, I mean, in some sense, these are more fundamental. They're much easier to compute, and they have a better topological meaning. So I would rather look at it this way and say, you know, here is Alexander, and it's the central thing. The new stuff is a minor perturbation of it. And the Collar-Jones polynomial is a funny way of summing these new things. OK. Okay, and now let me start with some content. Okay, so there is a general technique for obtaining knot invariants from algebras, and let me call it the Young-Baxter technique. And this technique, I'm fully happy with it. Okay, that's not where opinions diverge yet. So basically, you choose an algebra A. Typically, it's the universal developing algebra of some Lie algebra, or possibly a quantized version thereof. And you choose two elements. One element called R is in A tensor A, and it's called the R matrix, or a solution of Young-Baxter equation, or the value of the crossing. And I write it here as a sum of AI tensor BI, where AI and BI are elements of A. And it's supposed to solve the so-called Young-Baxter equation, which is really the Rademeister 3 move. And then there is a second element, C, which really is the value that you associate to caps and caps, and it's best to forget it, at least in first iteration. It's much caps. And then you just start reading from the beginning, and you see a C times an AI times a BJ times an AK times a C times a C times a BI times an AJ times a BK times a C. This is the expression written over here. And the invariant is basically this expression summed over all the indices, I, J, and K. And the moment R satisfies the so-called Young-Baxter equation, this really is an invariant. And I guess C has to be appropriately compatible too, and I don't know about this. Okay? The problem is that typically the algebra is pretty messy. The algebra A is a universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra, which makes it infinite dimensional. So all of these computations are happening inside an infinite dimensional algebra. And then the question is, how do you extract information out of this infinite, value which is computed inside an infinite dimensional algebra? So solution number zero is to, well, everything is graded, you crop at some finite degree, and then you compute only to a finite degree where everything is finite dimensional. And that works, but the invariants you get turn out to be, well, actually, these are all finite type invariants, or close to all finite type invariants. But the complexity grows very quickly with the degree at which you crop. So in practice, only the first few are reachable. and they're not terribly harmony.
So that's not a great solution.
Solution number two, hereby called the dogma, is to choose a representation. So you choose a representation of the algebra A, and then each one of these algebra elements becomes a matrix, and then, but a finite size matrix, and then you end up having to contract all of these matrices with each other, and that's a finite procedure, and it generates basically all quantum invariants, all Reshetich Turayev invariants. But the problem is exactly the problem that I mentioned at the beginning. You end up having a matrix or a pair of matrices, pair crossings, and then you need to regard, before contracting, you need to regard them in some big tensor power of spaces. The dimensions grow exponentially. The computation time is very, very slow. Okay? And here's the loyal opposition, me, or us. Okay? So, the claim is that for certain algebras, so, and I will in a minute tell you what are these algebras, so for certain algebras you can do something else. So instead of working in the space A tensor to the S, so S is the set of strands of a tangle, and A tensor to the S is the space where a tangle will attain its values. And you really always are working in A tensor to the S, because you know, you first start by considering your knot as a funny tangle which is made of crossings that are not yet connected to each other, and then you can start stitching these crossings to each other by connecting strands and at the same time multiplying algebra elements. So you always build up from spaces of the form A tensor to the S by applying various multiplication operations to them. So you work with A tensor to the S, and to that, and then there are operations on that collection of spaces, namely MIJK, which takes the ith tensor copy with the and multiplies it with the jth tensor copy, and places the output on the kth tensor copy, and you can formulate all the computations in terms of these MIJKs. And then the idea is, instead of representing these spaces, you find a relatively small space of formulas that represent elements in these spaces. So you find a space F sub S of formulas for strands with F for the potential values of invariants of tangles with S strands. Now that space of formulas, each formula can be interpreted as an element. So there is a certain interpretation map E. I call it E because it's very near to exponentiation, even though it's not precisely. And the conditions are that that space of formulas will grow relatively slow, so it will grow, its size will be polynomial in the size of S, as opposed to exponential in the size of S. And the second condition is that on that space of formulas, you should have the same operations as there are on the space of values, and furthermore, the interpretation map between them should be homomorphic, should be a homomorphism, should respect the operations. And of course, once you have that, you can compute things in polynomial time. Now, so I said it works, but it works only for certain algebras. So let me tell you about the algebras for which it works, for which this approach works. Any questions, by the way? Does this make sense so far? Okay. So for the algebras for which this works, I have to tell you a little bit about sort of
the world of Lie algebras.
So, you know, there is a standard thing that everybody knows, that semi-simple Lie algebras cannot be deformed. And in fact, quantum groups are not deformations of algebras, they are deformations of their universal enveloping algebras. So that standard thing is true, but not entirely true. Okay? So here is the moduli space of all Lie algebras on a certain vector space V. So if you pick a fixed vector space V, you can look at the set of all Lie algebra structures that you can put in it, on it. A Lie algebra structure, so a bracket, is an element in V dual squared tensor V, because every Lie bracket gets two inputs and produces an output. And such an element in V dual squared tensor V is supposed to satisfy the Jacobi identity, which amounts to being a quadratic equation, and also antisymmetry, which I don't know what it means, but it's something small. Okay? So in some sense, so the space of Lie algebras on a vector space V is a quadratic variety on some finite dimension. Okay? And here is a schematic fake. I'm not even pretending that this is the right picture. In fact, the right picture is not known, except in some very few low-dimensional cases. But here is a schematic fake picture of that moduli space. So here is the Lie algebra E9. There isn't such a thing, but we're in fake moduli spaces, so it doesn't matter. Here is F5, and here is SL17 plus. So SL17, you all know what it is, and in fact, I tend to work in the plus version of Lie algebras, and the plus version is where you take the original semi-simple Lie algebra and add a second copy of the Cartan to it. You'll see in a minute why. So SL17 plus is really SL17 plus a second copy of the Cartan, so plus a 16-dimensional additional abelian Lie algebra added to it. Okay? Now, each of these algebras, E9, F5, and SL17 plus, is semi-simple, and the fact that it's semi-simple means that the component of the moduli space it lives in is open, which means that if you look at a Lie algebra near E9 or near SL17, it will still be isomorphic to SL17. So really, the moduli space is decomposed into... No, why don't I lower it a bit? So it is decomposed into chambers. Why don't I lower it a bit? Because my mouse isn't working. Oh, here now it's working. Good. Is decomposed into chambers, and you know, there's one chamber for SL17, one for E9, one for F5, and so on. And the fact that you can't deform Lie algebras is the fact that these chambers are open. Okay? Now, you cannot deform Lie algebras, but you can do something else. You can choose a path inside this chamber. So this is the path SL17 sub epsilon. It's a path that depends on some parameter epsilon. And this, which goes from one wall of the chamber into, I don't care where, maybe into another wall. Okay? So as epsilon goes to zero, for every non-zero value of epsilon, you get a Lie algebra with different structure constants than SL17, but still isomorphic to SL17. But when epsilon goes to zero, you get a Lie algebra on the wall here, on the wall between two chambers, and such a Lie algebra and that one will no longer be SL17. In fact, it will be a solvable Lie algebra. And then, so really you cannot deform semi-simple Lie algebras, but you can degenerate them. In other words, you can find a Lie algebra SL17-0, which is solvable, and yet which can be deformed to be SL17. So the trick, the Lie algebras I will work with, will be SL17 epsilon near epsilon equals to 0. So near this solvable algebra. And what I mean by near, more precisely, is that I will consider SL17 epsilon over the ring Q adjoined epsilon modulo epsilon to the power k plus 1 is equal to 0. So if k is equal to 0, I'm modding out by epsilon is equal to 0. I'm setting epsilon to be equal to 0. So I'm really talking about this solvable Lie algebra which happens here. And when I raise k, I'm sort of allowing myself to be farther and farther away from this solvable Lie algebra, but the resulting Lie algebra that I get is still solvable. And I work in that one. So one word about why are solvable Lie algebras any good. So basically the kind of operation, so the kind of operations that we will that you need to do in order to compute quantum invariants often involve matrix exponentiation. And contrary to common beliefs, computations in semi-simple Lie algebras are actually horrible. So, you know, you can test it very simply. So simply take the square 2x2 matrix, A, B, C, D, exponentiate it, and simplify the result and print it in matrix form. So just print it as a matrix and hit enter on your computer. Well, let me hit enter on my computer. Where is the mouse? Here. So I'll hit enter, and I hope you can see the result. Can you see it? So the result, whatever it is, involves, well, just horrible expressions, okay, including hyperbolic functions, square roots, when the matrices will grow bigger. I mean, after all, how do you exponentiate a matrix? You diagonalize, which means you solve an equation, so you end up dealing with algebraic numbers. You get horribleness. And if you want to do operations to such things, you very quickly find that you lose. You can't. Okay? However, if you're talking about the solvable Lie algebra, then everything is simple. So, for example, if you a solvable Lie algebras are essentially the upper triangular or embed into upper triangular matrices. So, if I'll just show you computations within upper triangular matrices, I've shown you things that work for all solvable Lie algebras. So, let's exponentiate A, B, 0, C. Put the output in matrix form, and the answer is completely reasonable. It's a polynomial in the original variables and their exponentials, sorry, not a polynomial, a rational function. And rational functions are something that's very easy to manage. And also, A and e to the A are algebraically independent. So really, these are rational functions in two sets of variables, and this is something that's relatively easy to manage. And in fact, even better, so even if you try to do the BCH formula, which is too horrible to even speak of in the case of semi-simple Lie algebras, so you take the product of two solvable matrices, sorry, you take two solvable matrices, A1, B1, C1, exponentiate each, and similarly A to B to C to, exponentiate both, multiply the two exponentials, take the logarithm of the result, and simplify it. And again, the result is ugly, I'll admit that. But if you look at it very carefully, so here is the result, if you look at it very carefully, you see that it's still just rational function in
the variables and their exponentials, which is something that computers can manage very easily. So that's the key point. That's the reason why we care about solvable algebras. Okay, but now I have to tell you about this degeneration process. So how do you start from an algebra and move towards a solvable algebra? So here it is. So maybe I'll first do it for GLN because it's the easiest, and then you'll have to believe me that the same thing works for every semi-simple algebra. So for GLN, and let me start by doing it schematically. So schematically, I think of GLN as the direct sum of the upper triangular matrices, which are denoted here by upper triangles, and lower triangular matrices, which are denoted here by lower triangles. And really, upper triangular and lower triangular intersect in the diagonal matrices. So if you decompose GLN as a lower triangular plus upper triangular, really you end up getting GLN plus an extra copy of the diagonal matrices, and that's why I keep this extra copy. It's just easier to work with things this way. Anyway, the deformation is that you keep the brackets of upper triangular matrices as they were. However, you sort of fade out the lower triangular matrices by a factor of epsilon. And again, I'm thinking of epsilon as being either zero or a small number, and small in the sense of that. Okay? So if you take the bracket of a lower triangular with a lower triangular matrix, then you just use the old value but multiply it by epsilon. And then there is a certain rule about how to take the bracket of an upper triangular with a lower triangular matrix. So if you take an upper triangular and a lower triangular matrix, typically the bracket will have two components, a component which is the upper triangular and a component which is the lower triangular. And what you do is you take you multiply by epsilon the upper part of the output. Okay? And the claim is that for any value of epsilon, this gives you a valid Lie algebra. Furthermore, for epsilon equals, for any finite value of epsilon, meaning non-zero and not infinity, you can rescale epsilon away, and you get back the original GLN you started from. So GLN plus the additional abelian component. And furthermore, however, for epsilon equals to zero, so essentially what remains is only the upper triangular part, which is clearly solvable. And for small epsilon, namely if epsilon to the k is equal to zero, then you still have the lower part, but it somehow faded away. You can visit it only k times before you die out, and that makes the whole thing solvable. Now, I can make all of this much more formal. So, more formally, there is this dreamful double construction which says that any semi-simple Lie algebra together with a second copy of the Cartan can be recovered from its upper Borel subalgebra by the dreamful double construction. And the dreamful double construction involves starting from a solvable Lie algebra, so the upper Borel, and a bracket and a co-bracket. And basically all I'm doing, or what this process was to take the co-bracket and multiply it by epsilon. That's all I do. Okay. Questions, comments?
Okay. So maybe the simplest example is SL2. So in the case of SL2, so the upper Borel is generated by by H and E, and then the lower Borel will be generated by a pair L and F, and you do the process that I just described, and you find that overall SL2 at epsilon is the algebra generated by H, E, L, and F, and with the commutation relations written over here. So, well, I don't have much to say about it. Here they are. And then let GK be this G epsilon algebra subject to the relation that I wrote here. So epsilon to the K plus 1 is equal to 0. And again, I'm doing it here for SL2, but the same thing could have been done for any Lie algebra. And now I can say the main theorem. So the GK invariant of any S-component tangle can be written in the form. So here is a formula for the answer. So implicitly what I'm doing here is I'm describing the space of allowable formulas within which all work will occur. So the formula is, so ignore this part, I'll explain it in a minute. The interesting part of the formula is omega times the exponential of L plus Q plus P. Omega is a scalar. A scalar in our constant, in our context, means a rational function in the variables hi and their exponentials ti. So what do I mean by that? So first of all, so if you look at h here, you see that h is central. H commutes with everything else, which means that you can regard it as a variable. You can pull it out of all formulas at no cost. So you can regard it as a variable. And if the value of an invariant is going to be in the algebra A to the tensor to the power S, then you're going to have an H variable for each tensor factor. So really, if you're looking at the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra raised to the power S, then that's the same as the universal enveloping algebra of the direct sum of S copies of that Lie algebra. So there is one copy of H for each strand. So I regard the H's, as coefficients, and since exponentials of H's occur many times, I also set Ti to be the exponential of Hi, and then omega is a scalar, which means a rational function in these variables Hi and their exponentials. Then L is a certain quadratic form, so more precisely, L is sum of Aij, Hi, Lj, where the Aijs are not even scalars, they're just integers. So L is really not interesting, it's actually related to the linking matrix. Q is again a quadratic, but it's a quadratic in the Eis and the Fjs, with coefficients Bijs, which in themselves are scalars. And finally, P is a polynomial of a bounded degree. I think the degree is at most 2d plus 2. Sorry, 2k plus 2, or k is the overall degree. P is essentially a polynomial in all the variables that can participate, namely in the variables EI, LI, and FI, which generates the copies of G,
beyond the HIs, which are regarded as scalars. Okay?
Excuse me.
So, yeah?
I mean, I can interrupt you. Now, when you say the GK invariant, do you propose a new construction, or do you use some previous...
So, the construction is the Young-Baxter construction that
so
I mentioned before, and I haven't yet written the R matrix. But I claim that there is an R matrix, and in fact, the claim is simply because there is an R matrix for SL2 epsilon, for any epsilon, because it's always just SL2, and essentially you take the limit.
So you say that there should be a Riemann structure on new algebra.
There is an R matrix and a C on the new algebra, and out of it you can construct an invariant, and I'm describing now the space of formulas in which this invariant lives. Okay?
So our matrix,
and I haven't yet finished what?
Our matrix is not coming from the double construction?
It is.
Okay.
Okay? So, I haven't yet finished the description of the space of formulas. So my formulas, well, I still haven't told you how to interpret these formulas, but now you know what they are. So the formulas are a scalar times the exponential of a three-part thing, a simple-minded quadratic L, a complicated quadratic Q in these variables, and, a complicated quadratic Q as written over here, and a polynomial P in these variables of a bounded degree. And the point is that if you count, there is a polynomial amount of information in such formulas. Namely, so basically a matrix, so you have one scalar. Okay, it's not a scalar because it's a rational function, the one last thing that you do is if you identify all the HIs and call them a single H, and likewise all the TIs and call them a single T, then the result is polynomial time computable. So before this identification, it's still actually exponential time. But anyway, so the scalars are rational functions in a single variable and its exponential, so there is a polynomial amount of information there. The quadratic is just a matrix of size S by S is, again, quadratic amount of information, so it's a matrix of scalars, but it's still a polynomial amount of information. And even P, which is a polynomial of bounded degree, so the size of the space of polynomials grows polynomially and not exponentially. So somehow, the key to the computability is the fact that, that this space of formulas is bounded in size. Okay? And now I have to tell you how to interpret these formulas as formulas for elements in spaces like this. And the answer is simply, well, if you have a polynomial in EI, LI, and FI, you can view it, so it's a commutative polynomial, or if you have an exponential, so if you have a general function, or a power series in such variables, then it's a commutative polynomial, but you can also view it as an element in the universal enveloping algebra, essentially by choosing a PBW basis. So basically, by thinking of several copies of the universal enveloping algebras as being several lines, and you just declare that on line number one, you plant all the E's before all the L's, before all the F's, and then on line number two, you'll plant E2, and then L2, and then F2, and then on line number three, you'll plant the third L. So E3, L3, F3.
Okay, so if basically, once you decide on the ordering of the variables along the strands, and the decision is written over there, so you put an F on each strand, then you can turn commutative polynomials into non-commutative polynomials. Okay? Okay, so now the theorem is fully stated, with technicalities omitted. And then, the point, and then, but why is it true? Okay? So, it's true because of the following lemma. So, okay, so now suppose I wanted to multiply, so the key point is to implement multiplication in the universal enveloping algebra at the level of formulas. In other words, suppose I concatenate these two strands. So I connect the head of that to the tail of that, and now I have a long strand in which I have an elf followed by a second elf, and I want to know how to reorder the variables at the level of formulas so as to replace it by a single elf. And the first thing I need to do is to commute this L across this F. After that, I will need to, commute this F across this E. After that, I will need to commute a bunch of L's across a bunch of F's, or a bunch of L's across a bunch of E's. And basically, I have to tell you how this is done. So, in a generally algebra, it would be extremely difficult. However, in these solvable approximations of semi-simple algebras, it turns out that you can write explicit formulas. And here they are. So, if you want to bring an exponential of gamma times L plus beta times E from the order LE to the order EL, here is how you do it. So the exponential of gamma L plus beta LE plus beta E in the order LE is equal to the exponential of gamma L plus E to the gamma beta E in the order EL. So I just told you how to switch from one order to the other. And then it's a little exercise that you do on the side to check that the formulas that I wrote before, so this formula over here, when viewed from the perspective of a single E and a single L, is simply a formula of the form written here, and that when you apply to it the transformation suggested by this formula, you get again a formula of the same kind. Okay? And likewise, when you want to commute Fe, an F across an E, so if you want to write E to the beta E plus alpha F plus delta E F, and you can check that all formulas that I write are of that form for some specific values of alpha, beta, and delta, which is, I mean, these values are themselves complicated functions of the coefficients of L and Q and P. So basically, you can check that, so if you want to to rewrite an exponential like this from the FE order to the EF order, and it turns out that an L gets created in the middle, so if you wanted to bring it to L form, then that exponential becomes that one, where the ingredients are defined below, and it doesn't really matter what they are, the point is that they are of the same kind that I'm allowing. So I stay within the same space of formulas. And that's basically the proof of the theorem. I mean, sorry, the additional thing that has to be done is, as Christian sort of said, is I have to tell you that the R matrix is itself of that kind, and it is. So basically, that's all. Programming it turns out to be very easy, and a full demo program is given on page 2 of your handout. I'll just sort of highlight one part of it. So here is the part where you commute an F across an E, and well, I'm not even going to read it out, but if you look at what is written here, it's basically the formulas that I wrote on the previous blackboard converted into computer code. So you get the, you know, short and concise programs, which at the end compute, as I said before, anything you wish, and relatively quickly. Again, you may hate the complexity, but you cannot argue with the fact that this is that it is the strongest computable invariant we have. Okay? And as for arguing, as for hating the complexity, I don't think it's justified. I mean, you may argue that these formulas are complicated, but once you get used to them, they're not any more complicated than the formulas that you're already used to in the language of representation theory. They're just different. I think I'll stop here. Sorry, I ended up leaving only 2 minutes for fighting and arguing.
Okay, so fighting arguments.
Yeah.
I don't want to fight, but probably you can recover Alexander polynomial with this kind of model.
Of course, set epsilon to be zero.
And can you recover, can you get some invariant with some topological meaning?
So, you know, I think I started by my talk by saying, there is much more at web/talks. So I've given many, many talks about the Alexander polynomial. Coming from this approach, even though I didn't yet know that that was the approach it was coming from. So basically, if you look at other places, you'll see that I've described formulas for the Alexander polynomial in the language of tangles, by essentially manipulating matrices of rational functions, which are exactly these L and Q. P turns out to be zero in that case. And these manipulations are a tangle generalization. On the one hand, are a tangle generalization of the Alexander polynomial, which can be used to compute the Alexander polynomial, and from a second perspective, this is actually the fastest way to compute the Alexander polynomial. So the Alexander polynomial had always been polynomial time, but if you use these techniques, it's actually faster. So in fact, Nathan Dunfield uses techniques to compute the Alexander polynomial of knots with up to 1,000 crosses. I don't know if it answers your question. I don't know, Gregor maybe?
So when I look at this on the top corner of the, I mean it's pretty much there, so there are the row case of the LSTR. Can you maybe show them on the screen? The row case of the, I mean this formula, in order to the right.
Yeah, you know, just scrolling.
Yes. So those row case. So if I understand correctly, you can compute rho k in polynomial time.
Yeah.
But how is it related to the epsilon to the k? Is it the same k?
Yes.
Okay. That was my question.
Okay. That was.
Yeah, you can maybe.
And that's a theorem, right? That's a theorem. Oh.
Nothing is written. There are talks about it. Which again I've given you the reference. There are programs that compute things. There is still a huge amount of work to do, and you know, so I have employment for the next few years. But you know, if you want to be strict, you can call it a conjecture. But I don't know what I'm doing.
Never mind the nature of theorem.
It's true.
But the statement, can I perform it like this? If I compute the Kaler-Jones for this algebra SL2 sub k, or g sub k, or epsilon, I forgot what the notation was.
Yeah.
I mean, the k version of SL2.
Yeah.
Then I will get this extension up to rho k.
Exactly.
That's the statement.
That's the statement, yes. But you do it quickly. That's somehow the point. And A, you do it quickly, and B, what you will do is actually extremely powerful and has topological relations. Whereas the original thing doesn't, not in the same way at least. Yes, Stavros?
So, presumably rho k is polynomial in a number of crossings.
Yes.
Of degree linear in k.
Yes.
And presumably 3k or something like that.
Yes.
So if you want.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Indeed.
And maybe.
So again, sort of.
Okay.
You know, you may have to wait a few years until it's all fully understood. Partially, it's my slowness, and partially, it's my ignorance. In other words, I don't have all the I learn the techniques as I use them.
And maybe an answer to Christian's question. So this way, you can only extract topological invariants which are invariant under commutation.
This is if you start from SL2, but
yes.
Nothing in principle
yes.
prevents you from doing it with SL3.
Sure.
From doing it with SL3. And, you know, that's... Wait a couple months. Or do it yourself.
Other more questions?